American values at risk today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Luis Mancheno is originally from Ecuador. Now he's in New York and planning to vote in his first U.S. election in the name of diversity.
Voting for me this time will mean voting on saying being different is fine and it's great. And that's what the U.S. is about.
Also, why some Syrian refugees are giving up on Europe.
They had had it. There was no hope for them in Greece. They had waited a long time for relocation to another European country, and they were giving up and going back.
Plus, immigrants in Louisiana fight for their right to marry.
Denying the right of some people to marry simply because of where they were born, I think is un-American and absurd.
Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Of all the crises around the globe, the most pressing one for the next president will probably be Syria. We'd really like to hear more from the two candidates on how they deal with the war there, but with the election next Tuesday and other distractions getting in the way, I wouldn't count on it. That is a real shame, and you'll see why with our first story. Some of the people who fled the war in Syria, who survived terrifying boat rides in flimsy dinghies, who risked everything to make it to Europe, they're actually giving up on their dream and returning to Syria.
It's consistent movement, and it's also based on consistent despair about what's going on in Greece.
Correspondent Jean Carstensen has been following the refugee story for the past few years from Greece. She says she started noticing a trickle of Syrians reversing course last summer. More recently, she met refugees on the Greek border with Turkey along the Evros River, where she saw families setting out on the long trip back to Syria.
We saw a group of Syrian families leaving from the Didymotiko train station to walk back towards the Evros River, which is the dividing line between Greece and Turkey. We spoke with them briefly, and they told us they had paid 100 euros each to get into a boat and cross this river, and they had had it. There was no hope for them in Greece. They had waited a long time for relocation to another European country, and they were giving up and going back. And it's variations of this story that is driving Syrians to pay again. They already paid a smuggler around $1,000 to come to Greece in the first place in those terrible dinghies. And now here they are paying to go back because they couldn't get help.
Yeah, that's incredible. I'd like listeners to hear a 21-year-old woman you met, Hadil Al-Akhmad is her name. She's pregnant with her first child. She's from Raqqa in Syria, which is a place now controlled by ISIS. And she's in Kavala camp in Greece. This is how she describes how she and her fellow refugees are deciding what to do next.
Everybody in here wait answer from the asylum service by telephone. If send them to good countries, okay, no problem, go. But if they're bad countries, go back to Syria. Yeah.
And do they have to pay money to a smuggler?
Yeah. You have to pay money again.
So, Jean, someone like Hadil Al-Akhmad, what reasons did she give for considering a return home?
Well, people have been waiting a long time. The Syrians have access to this relocation program, which could take them to another European country, but they don't get to choose where they go. And so some people have waited 7 months, and then they find out they're getting relocated to Romania or countries like Romania that are pretty poor and also aren't very welcoming to refugees. So some, when they get this news, decide to go back.
Do you hear that a lot, that the waiting game is just too much and they're wasting their time, so that's why they're going home?
The waiting game is really just too brutal. I think when people got stuck in Greece in March, they were willing to wait. But as these months go by, they no longer have money. And then on top of that, after they do all of this waiting and finally get news about relocation, it's often disappointing news to a country that's not welcoming to refugees. And they decide really it's a better option for them to return.
There's another reason they want to leave, and that's the conditions in these refugee camps. Here's 21-year-old Syrian Hadil Al-Akhmad again, describing why some of her fellow refugees now see life back in Syria as better to what they're experiencing in camps in Greece.
The weather's so bad, no clean in bathroom, in toilet. The food also not good, insects. So difficult conditions.
It sounds really tough, but could it actually be worse than going back to Syria? I mean, this is a country in one of the most devastating wars of recent times.
Well, people really get ground down by these conditions. The camps aren't winterized. You don't have money, say, to buy anything for your kids to supplement your diet. So after a while, people start to feel humiliated, which is a word that you hear a lot. And so for some people, even though they're going back into a war zone or near a war zone, what they tell me, and this is versions of this you hear again and again, is, I'd rather die one time in Syria. Here in Greece, we're dying 1,000 times.
It seems some of the Syrians understand what's going on with Greece, and they're hard-pressed to kind of get more from the Greek government. You spoke with a former policeman named Thayer El-Nahir. What did he tell you about that?
Well, he said he really likes the Greek people. The Greek people are wonderful, and this is something that you hear again and again from the refugees. They appreciate the kindness, willingness to help of the Greek people, but Greeks are broke. At 23% unemployment, it's the highest unemployment rate in the EU right now, and there is just not sufficient care for these people who are seeking international asylum and protection.
Reporter Jane Carstensen, you can read her full report about how Syrian refugees are now paying smugglers to take them back to Syria on our website, PRI.org. Jane, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
More than 12,000 refugees from Syria have been admitted to the U.S. this year, and the federal government has planned to admit even more next year. But at the same time, some states have passed local laws that make life tougher for immigrants and refugees. Louisiana, for example, it now has a law requiring people born outside of the U.S. to show a birth certificate to get married. Nina Feldman has that story from New Orleans.
Ana Maria Lopez was born in Colombia, but has lived in the States for years. She's a citizen. One morning, Lopez went to get her marriage license with her fiancé, Peter. He's a citizen, too.
We were both really excited, Peter and I.
When it was their turn, they handed the clerk their paperwork.
And the lady, right away off the bat, just kind of gave us an attitude. She treated us differently than the couple that had gone up before us.
The clerk wouldn't accept Lopez's birth certificate. It was a photocopy.
Because in Colombia, when you lose your birth certificate, you have to go back to the town where you were born, and essentially there's a book with records, and they just make a photocopy of the page where your birth certificate is. And that's as official as it's going to get.
But the answer was still no. Until this year, you could get a waiver if you didn't have a birth certificate. But a new law passed in January got rid of that option for people born outside of the U.S. And that's tricky for many immigrants. Maybe they can't access their birth certificate, or never even got one. Or maybe they're a refugee who fled their country with just the clothes on their back. Eventually, Lopez spoke to an official who knew how the system worked in Colombia. She and Peter got their license.
You know, I am lucky. It could have stopped us from getting married.
The House will come to order. The clerk will open the machine.
State Representative Valerie Hodges sponsored the bill, arguing it would prevent marriage fraud. But critics like Representative Marcus Hunter were skeptical this was a real issue.
How many instances of marriage fraud do we have in Louisiana presently?
Well, we do have marriage fraud in Louisiana. In fact, one case was in my church that my husband...
Hodges explained that her husband, a pastor, had married someone who'd already been married.
So and one instance is why we're bringing this legislation to tighten up marriage.
There's more.
Hodges gave examples of marriage fraud in other states. She brought up the fake marriage connected to the deadly attack in San Bernardino, California last year. She says this bill would prevent that in Louisiana. Mary Yannick is an attorney with the New Orleans Worker Center for Racial Justice. She says the bill just adds to other laws that make life tough for the state's growing immigrant community. If you're undocumented here, you can't get a driver's license or receive in-state college tuition.
It's an attack on immigrant families and their ability to build community in Louisiana. That is a part of marriage, is building their relationships here.
Now, some immigrant rights groups are fighting the law in court.
Denying the right of some people to marry simply because of where they were born, I think is un-American and absurd.
That's Alvaro Huerta from the National Immigration Law Center, one of the groups that's suing. He argues that even if marriage fraud is a problem, that's for the federal government to decide. But bills like this, singling out immigrants and couples, aren't new. Mei Nai, a historian at Columbia University, points to the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. It barred Chinese workers from entering the country and from bringing their wives if they were already here.
It's very explicit. They didn't want women to come to the United States because they didn't want families and they didn't want a settled population.
Nai also points to the Expatriation Act of 1907. That forced women who married a foreigner to renounce their U.S. citizenship. Representative Hodges says she never meant for the law to affect people who are here legally and plans to tweak it so it won't. But those suing say the fundamental right to marry should be protected regardless of immigration status and that the law should be scrapped entirely. For The World, Nina Feldman, New Orleans.
This week, we're hearing from immigrants and refugees who are voting for the first time in a U.S. election. People like Luis Mancheno from Quito, Ecuador. Luis is an immigration lawyer who lives in Brooklyn now. He first came to the U.S. in 2008. He was 21 then and seeking asylum after being persecuted in Ecuador for being gay. For him, this election is about making sure the United States remains a safe space for people like himself.
It's a very interesting time for myself and for the country. For the first time, I actually think that the existence and all of the values of this country are at risk. The reason why I came to the U.S. was to find a place that was open to people who were fleeing persecution, open to people who wanted to prosper in this country. And that is the reason that now, as an immigration attorney, I know is behind every single one of the clients that I represent in immigration court. After the Orlando massacre in June, I started feeling as vulnerable as I felt when I was in Ecuador for being gay. The people who were killed in Orlando the majority of them were Latinos. A lot of them came from immigrant families. A lot of them went to that club that night to find refuge within the city of Orlando. And hearing how especially the Republican nominee and other Republican members vilified immigrants and refugees after the massacre was really, really scary to me because that I felt that I was not only being targeted because of being gay by this act of terrorism, but I was also being targeted because of being an immigrant. People take for granted the ability to just simply not be noticed. Sometimes the only thing that I wanted when I was in Ecuador was to not be noticed. And that is something that I have been able to get here, to not get weird looks or to not get weird reactions to the fact that I say I'm married to a man. Same thing with being an immigrant, right? When I talk, I have a foreign accent. And sometimes all I wished for was to actually fit, to actually not be seen. But I have embraced the fact that I'm different. And I think that voting for me this time will mean voting on saying being different is fine and it's great. And that's what the U.S. is about.
Brooklyn-based immigration lawyer Luis Mancheno. You can read his essay about voting in a U.S. election for the first time at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Russia makes a lot of its neighbors nervous. They look at Russia's interventions in Ukraine, including its annexation of Crimea in 2014, and wonder, could they be next? In the Baltic states, defense spending is up, and NATO has deployed extra troops to discourage a Russian attack. And one of those Baltic nations, Estonia, is taking matters a step further. It's training its citizens in guerrilla warfare, and if it's even possible, they're trying to make it fun. The New York Times' Andrew Kramer was just in Estonia, so tell us about these patrol games, Andrew. What's exactly going on?
In these games, volunteers, these are men, women, and teenagers, compete in 24-hour competitions in the various skills that would be needed for an insurgent.
So this is a competition. It's scored because I guess there are winners. How do they score this?
It's scored based on 21 tasks that the competitors have to fulfill. These are things like putting out a fire, carrying a wounded colleague on a horse, assembling an assault rifle. And for each of these tasks, they receive points. They also have something they call life cards, which they carry with them, and they have the occupying army, or rather people pretending to be the occupying army, hunting for them in the forest and firing guns, shouting, stomping around. And if they catch a team, the team members have to hand over their life cards, and this detracts points from their score.
Right, so that would have been the moment where they're captured and maybe executed. So how many lifeguards do they get?
They get 12, unlike in real life.
Right, well, 12, that's 9 more than Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Men, women, and teens, I mean, is there kind of a profile of the kind of people who are signing up for this? Are they war buffs? Do they want to be soldiers?
Well, the comparison that this group makes, the group is called the Estonian Defense League, is to the American National Guard, although there is a distinction, obviously, in the types of skills they teach. These are ordinary people. They like to say they're a cross-section of the community. Anybody from an electrician to a county administrator, for example. They have doctors, white-collar professionals, and they have teenagers, and some also who are planning to join the Army. So obviously somebody who would sign up for this has an inclination to play guerrilla or play the underground, but they are, by intent, a cross-section of Estonian society.
Right, so kind of a mixed bag. I'm just wondering if, their reasons for doing it, are they looking at Russia and really concerned, or are they thinking, better safe than sorry?
I think they're looking at Russia and are concerned. Now, this group has existed for more than 100 years in Estonia, but they're paying particular attention to it now.
So they are aware that an attack on Estonia, per the NATO agreement, that would trigger a war with all of NATO. I mean, even if the country is occupied, NATO, including the U.S., would be committed to liberating them, right?
That's right. When I asked one of the participants about that very question, they said, well, our job is to defend our country until our allies come, if they come. And I think that last part is important because some people in Estonia don't really believe that the president of the United States, for example, would risk nuclear war with Russia to defend the town of Turi in Estonia.
I was going to ask you about that because Estonia has actually been meeting NATO payments. Do they worry, though, about what might happen with a candidate Trump saying, we won't come to the rescue unless everybody's meeting payments?
They do. And I met one volunteer in this group during a break in the competition. He was oiling his machine gun and talking about Trump. And he said something to the effect that he believed Trump was crazy and irresponsible. And so he was taking matters into his own hands by keeping his gun oiled.
Wow. Andrew Kramer, Moscow correspondent with the New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
The current tensions with Russia have many worried about a new Cold War. Scary thought. Just ask anybody who remembers their duck and cover drills. For our next story, though, we're going even further back in time to before the Soviet era. I'm talking about the late 19th century when a world-famous Russian composer came to this city, Boston, to debut what would become his most famous piano work. My WGBH colleague Edgar B. Herwick III looked into how that happened.
It's instantly recognizable. Bum, 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 bum.
The piano comes in with this accompaniment of really crashing chords. Boom, chum, bum, boom, chum. It is just so fine, so true, so wonderful.
The Piano Concerto No. 1, composed by Peter Ilyich Tchaikovsky. World-renowned pianist Mark Andre Hamelin explains, was pretty darn good at what he did.
Well, most importantly, I think Tchaikovsky is considered to be the greatest Russian composer who ever lived.
In his day, Tchaikovsky certainly was an important composer, but just one of many in a 19th century Russia teeming with them. And Brian McCreath from WGBH's classical music sister station WCRB says, Tchaikovsky sometimes found himself at odds with his contemporaries.
Other Russian composers were owning Russianness. And he wasn't really. He had a more cosmopolitan Western view of music or voice in music.
Perhaps that helps explain what happened in 1875 when Tchaikovsky first ran his new piece by a respected old friend. Here's Hamelin and McCreath.
He sought the advice of Nikolai Rubinstein, who was one of the greatest Russian pianists of the era. And Tchaikovsky very much wanted Nikolai Rubinstein to play the piece.
And in fact, that's part of the story of this concerto, that the first guy he's thinking of for it says, this is unplayable. What are you talking about?
Rubinstein's assessment did not exactly sit well with Tchaikovsky.
He takes it hard. He's not a calm, philosophical sort. He's a very emotional guy.
Well, that's documented, actually. He said before he left in a huff, he said, I won't change a note of it.
So Tchaikovsky changed pianists. He found a willing partner in Hans von Bülow, a German virtuoso whose career had been derailed when he lost his wife, Franz Liszt's daughter, to his idol, composer Richard Wagner.
He's sort of this guy who's rebuilding his life, and he sees Tchaikovsky's music, and, you know, he plays it through himself, and it's like, this is something special.
That von Bülow took up the cause is what set the concerto on its unlikely path to the Bay State. Von Bülow had a U.S. tour previously scheduled and decided to unveil the piece in Boston, a city that McCreath says was eager to establish itself as exactly the kind of place that would debut a new work by a great composer.
This is the United States trying to establish itself, and so therefore imitating what's going on in Europe.
And so on October 25th, 1875, at the Boston Music Hall, von Bülow took the stage.
With an apparently terrible orchestra, by the way. You know,
really?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they got through it, but it was doubtless not a great representative of what Tchaikovsky really had in mind. You know, it takes a while for a piece to really get its legs.
And get its legs, the concerto did.
Von Bülow stuck with it. He kept it on tour, and he played it in London not long afterwards, and it kind of took off. It kind of was one of Tchaikovsky's real triumphs.
Homlin says it's not Tchaikovsky's most masterful work. McCreath says it's not his most groundbreaking. But it is today an indispensable part of the classical music canon, and the legacy of one of the art form's true greats.
I think it just speaks to people in the way that music should, which is in a very genuine voice.
It'll never die. It's one of these pieces that, to me, seems like it's always been there. I mean, it's hard to imagine that there was a period where this piece didn't exist.
But, of course, there was. At least until it was first unveiled to the world, right here in Boston, 141 years ago. For The World, Edgar B. Herwig III. Boston.
News headlines are coming up next here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Visual artist Kehinde Wiley creates large Renaissance-style portraits, often in stained glass, and always featuring people of color.
At its best, what art does is it points to what we as human beings value. And if Black lives matter, they deserve to be in paintings.
My conversation with Kehinde Wiley, still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I guess my only question now is, after the big vote next Tuesday, will Trump and Clinton still be going at each other? And if yes, for how long? In a moment, what the day after an election looks like in places where things don't always go so smoothly. First, though, let's focus on a topic that is related in a way, how the U.S. government promotes democracy abroad. Some people think this year's highly unusual campaigns here at home will actually make it much harder for the U.S. to make a global push for democracy. Susan Glasser is the editor of Politico, and she says spreading democracy has long been a part of our national DNA.
It's always been embedded in some ways in our foreign policy, whether it's the notion that we would be a beacon of democracy merely by example or whether we would actively spread it. Really, the modern day policy of democracy promotion, the agencies and institutions that we have that do this kind of work are a legacy of the Cold War, and we're really where we saw democracy as a major advantage in the war of ideas with the Soviet Union.
Is there a classic success story of democracy promotion, you know, where the U.S. had a hugely positive effect on a country's democracy?
Well, look, I think for a long time it's been perceived as sort of a tool in the toolkit. People can go all the way back to the immediate chaotic years right after World War II and the Marshall Plan and, you know, the Truman Doctrine as it prevailed in Greece and other countries. And you see that combination of both military aid but also building up of civil society as being the great success. Now, again, in recent years, that's meant a much more sort of technocratic set of democracy building type initiatives, which have done good work in places all over the world, in Eastern Europe and in Africa, but nothing really at the level, of course, of the Marshall Plan or those early efforts to create big democracies.
What about an example of a failure of U.S. democracy promotion?
Well, George W. Bush, unfortunately, has really associated with state building in the Middle East, in Afghanistan after 9/11. We've spent billions, literally billions of dollars on something that it's hard to call a governing success. At this point, it still remains hardly a country, never mind one that we could say is a stable democracy, despite enormous amounts of aid. The same is true in Iraq.
What specifically about the campaigns of both Trump and Clinton have made selling democracy abroad harder, do you think?
Well, I wouldn't make an equivalence, honestly, between Trump and Clinton. The world is upset about Donald Trump. The world is not upset about Hillary Clinton. And every survey has shown that basically in every country in the world except for Putin's Russia, Trump is extraordinarily unpopular, and people are concerned about the introduction of potential instability into a world system that's already very taxed. And because Trump has questioned U.S. alliances, has seemed to support authoritarian-type leaders like Putin with compliments, people are wondering, what does that mean about the continuity of the American role in the world? So it's really been a very harmful episode already, regardless of the outcome next week. And it literally has been the only other thing that foreign interlocutors have wanted to talk about with me and with those I talk about as they travel around the world over this last year.
And do those observers see us and just get completely confused? Or are they looking at us critically and saying this is hypocritical for a country that promotes democracy?
There's just a deep level of concern. Is America not the country that I thought it was? Are these politics and these points espoused by Donald Trump, do they reflect a strand of American society that we didn't realize was really the case? And also, in a more practical sense, if he were to win, how harmful potentially could that be to the global economy, political instability, both domestically inside the United States as a result of this, and instability that would be caused by Trump potentially reevaluating our core alliances and our pretty fixed foreign policy positions that have more or less not changed that radically, even when we've changed between Democratic and Republican.
So, Susan, 6 days out from the election, that is a major qualifier there. Do you see the world becoming more democratic, and where does the U.S. fit into that?
You know, if anything, the events of the last year here in the United States, with the fraying of Europe and its alliance and the questions about the Brexit in Britain, you also have, of course, the very depressing set of outcomes from the Arab Spring revolutions of 2011. Initially, it looked like sort of a wave of Western-style democracy activists were going to prevail and create a new order in the very authoritarian Middle East. That has really not proven to be the case. So democracy has not been advancing over the last decade. You know, I think what we're seeing internationally is the same thing that we're seeing here at home, which is that for those who are committed to democracy, who are committed to a set of ideals that are enshrined in our Constitution, you actually have to fight for it. You have to do something about it.
Susan Glasser is the editor of Politico. Susan, always great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Many of us look at the bitterness and anger among U.S. voters in this year's presidential election and wonder what will happen after the votes are counted. I'm assuming that'll be this coming Tuesday or early Wednesday morning. But hey, remember the 2000 election? Three words, people. Palm Beach County. David Carroll and his staff at the Carter Center have monitored presidential elections from Nicaragua to Nepal, and they've seen what the day after looks like in all those places. So with all the talk of rigged elections, David, Donald Trump even urging his voters to try sending in a second ballot if they think the first one wasn't counted. Is the Carter Center monitoring the U.S. election next Tuesday, and why or why not?
No, we are not observing the U.S. elections, and we historically have not been involved in any way in the U.S. elections. Our focus is international. We believe it's important to be seen as impartial and independent. And given that President Carter, our founder, former President Jimmy Carter, is still active in the Democratic Party, we believe it would be difficult for everyone to see us as totally impartial.
So let's take a look at some countries where you have looked at the day after an election, where you were an observer. How often have you watched elections where a large block of voters comes out feeling ripped off?
It's not unusual. We've observed more than 100 elections I've been involved in, a large percentage of those over the years. And the nature of the places that we get involved is such that there's often a very high degree of mistrust in the election administration or in the ability for there to be a good process. So it's quite common that there is likely to be a very unhappy large segment of the population after the election.
As an observer to these elections, David, you don't just drop in on election day. You've got to be in these countries periodically in the ramp-up to this. So I'm just curious, how does the mood in the U.S. stack up right now, given what you've seen over the past year? How does it stack up against other countries ahead of their presidential vote?
You know, this is the first time that I can remember in all of my work on elections where the U.S. context is starting to rival what we've seen in other countries in terms of the very serious political divides, anxiety, concern, and even just the level of political discourse is worse than I've ever seen it in the United States.
So play that out. How do you think that might affect the outcome?
What the United States has an advantage in many countries is the level of transparency about our election administration here and election data and the ability of citizens, media, political parties, and others to really go and check the results. You know, we have a very decentralized system, and so there's things that will vary by state and even by county. But in general, across the board, there's a very good ability for the election data to be reviewed and analyzed and checked for accuracy. And we also have the ability to try to pursue any complaints through a variety of legal channels. And so I think those are two of the things that set us apart from other countries that may not have one or both of those that will hopefully be enough to contain what I think is going to be almost inevitably a large percentage of Americans who are unhappy with the result after the election.
When feelings, harsh feelings, bitter feelings erupt after an election, what have you seen other countries do to calm tensions, you know, bridge differences, try and unify voters?
Well, the two things that are most important, as I mentioned a minute ago, are the ability for there to be open, transparent access to election results by all key stakeholders involved in the elections, and also for there to be legal channels that are well-established, trusted, and available to the contestants to bring any complaints through those processes. If they're there and they function well, that can make a big difference. Lastly, the importance of strong leaders across the board who can, if they've lost, accept their result, and if they've won, be very magnanimous in reaching out to losers.
David Carroll, head of the Democracy Program for the Carter Center, speaking with us from Atlanta. Thank you very much, David.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Our election next week is of great interest in Japan, and the biggest issue there is security. Since World War II, the U.S. has stationed tens of thousands of troops in Japan. The Pentagon also has a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier stationed there. In essence, our military is Japan's last line of defense. GOP nominee Donald Trump says that should end. He argues the burden on the U.S. is too big and that rich countries like Japan need to start paying for their own defense, including nuclear weapons. My BBC colleague Rupert Wingfield Hayes reports from the southern Japanese island of Okinawa, home to the largest concentration of U.S. troops in Asia.
There are nearly 50,000 U.S. personnel based here in Japan, and another 25,000 Japanese work on the U.S. bases. Mr. Trump has accused Japan of freeloading off America and has threatened to withdraw U.S. forces from here if Japan doesn't start paying more. In the first presidential debate, he said, and I quote, "They should be paying us because we are providing tremendous service and we are losing a fortune." Is that true? Masaharu Shimanaka has worked on the U.S. Marine Corps base here in Okinawa for 20 years. Today he's chairman of the Okinawa Garrison Forces Labor Union. I ask him if he thinks Japan is taking a free ride on U.S. taxpayers.
Trump really has no clue. The Japanese government is paying to lease these vast areas the U.S. military uses. Japan also pays the salaries of all the Japanese working on U.S. bases in Okinawa. It even pays the electricity and water bills.
Mr. Shimonaka is correct. The Japanese government pays around $2 billion a year towards the cost of hosting American forces here. But it's not just the cost issue that upsets Mr. Shimonaka.
The U.S. military is not here only to defend Japan. Americans are here to ensure the stability of the whole region. Trump is not considering that. If he thought about it, he would not make such comments.
But Mr. Trump may have some fans here. Deep in the hills of northern Okinawa, elderly protesters are being dragged off the road by riot police. They're trying to stop construction vehicles from getting into a nearby U.S. military base. So I'm standing on a road in the hills of northern Okinawa, and you can hear the noise all around me. These are local activists who are trying to prevent the Japanese government and the U.S. Marine Corps from building new helicopter landing pads up here for the U.S. Marines to use for military exercises. These people want the U.S. military to leave. So what do they think about Mr. Trump's threats?
Mr. Trump makes lots of radical comments and even talk about removing all the U.S. bases from Okinawa. So I am a bit hopeful. But at the same time, I'm worried he will bring trouble if he becomes the U.S. president.
I guess it's a good thing, but when you listen to what he says, I have a big question about him. I worry he might violate human rights. I worry if he's going to make the right decision as a human being.
I try hard, but I find no one here who will express a positive opinion about a Trump presidency. Every twist and turn of the U.S. election is being followed in Japan on daytime talk shows with a growing sense of alarm. Glenn Fukushima is a senior fellow from the Center for American Progress. He spends a lot of time in Tokyo talking to senior leaders.
Well, most people in Japan have a real concern about Trump. They think that he's uninformed, that his views about Japan's economy is like 30 years old, that he doesn't really understand the extent to which Japan contributes to burden sharing and to paying for American forces in Japan. So I think there's a general view that he doesn't really know what he's talking about.
Japan has a big stake in the outcome, and it's clear if people here had a vote, it would go overwhelmingly to Hillary Clinton.
The BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes reporting there from Okinawa, Japan. Just enough time before the break to taste some new music from Cuban pianist Roberto Fonseca. Not a big name globally when he took over as the man on the keys for the Buena Vista Social Club, but in the years since, that's changed. Fonseca has blazed all sorts of new musical paths. The title of his new CD kind of sums up who he is and what he does. It's called Abuk. That would be Cuba backwards. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. Don't know if you've ever heard of a New York-based artist named Kehinde Wiley. An exhibit of his just opened recently in Paris. 10 large portraits in stained glass and oil on canvas. Each looks like a scene you'd expect from a religious Renaissance painting, but at the center of every piece, there's a contemporary person of color. Wiley is known for this sort of reinterpretation of traditional portraits.
I describe it as an intervention. I think that, by and large, most of the work that we see in the great museums throughout the world are populated with people who don't happen to look like me. As a child, I grew up studying and worshiping those great works of Western European painting, but I also wanted to fulfill the goal of feeling a certain personal presence in that work. And I think that's what you have.
Intervention is a really interesting word to use to describe what you do. It kind of implies that something ain't going right and you need to get in and kind of correct it.
Well, it's true. I mean, there is much to be said about being able to have a bully pulpit. Artists have a certain stand, a crate that we can stand on and say that this is not quite up to the occasion. We want things to change somehow. I'm not changing the world, let's face it. I'm making paintings. But in the end, what I'm pointing to are elements of the life, the world that we all know, the world that we all know to be beautiful, graceful, special in their own ways, that we need to see in museums. At its best, what art does is it points to who we as human beings and what we as human beings value. And if Black lives matter, they deserve to be in paintings.
So the whole idea of kind of using the traditional religious scene with a modern person of color, that's really interesting. You grew up in the late 80s in South Central L.A., right?
That's right.
Did you grow up in a religious home? I mean, because there is a lot of Christian iconography in your work.
I did grow up in a religious home. I'm not particularly religious myself, and I don't think it requires a religious outlook in order to appreciate the work. What I do want to point to in my work is the fidelity and the magic with which all of these artists created such amazing depictions of glory in the world. And sure, do we have to use that to talk about a divinity? Maybe not so much these days. But we can use it to talk about those things that we choose to value, that we choose to embrace. And the question is, what is that?
So Paris, where you've got your exhibit currently and where there are also plenty of museums where you can see kind of like these medieval and Renaissance paintings that you kind of base some of your own work on, what was the reaction to your portraits when you had the opening?
It's really profound. I mean, you have to know that most of the images that I was dealing with in Paris were of young black men between the ages of 18 and 35, a very sort of sweet spot demographic, holding young dead black babies in their arms, shot through the language of stained glass. How do we respond to that in America? Very differently than Paris. Paris has a new sense of national trauma with regards to its boundaries, its sense of self. America has a new sense of how we're going to be dealing with policing black bodies in the age of the cell phone. How does a painting get viewed at any given point? Well, Paris was different than America, and it must be. It was enjoyable beyond belief to be able to see the multiplicity of views that can be applied to one image.
Was there one specific reaction? You said, you know, it was kind of a profound moment, this opening.
I never had so many museum guards walk up to me like they did in Paris, where they said, "Oh, my God, I've never seen this many black bodies in a public space."
And those museum guards, were they black themselves? Were they happily surprised to see so many people of color there, or kind of were they white and just couldn't believe what was going on?
Well, what's interesting is that the museum guards who came up to me in Paris were both black, white, North African, really the full cloth of France. And they said to me, "I can't believe this many black bodies are in this space." The resplendent light coming out of that stained glass is not about nationhood. It's not about race. It's about being powerful in the world, glowing literally. And if art can be at the service of anything, it's about letting us see a state of grace for those people who rarely get to be able to see that way.
And you're also doing a special event here in the U.S. with the French Embassy. What is your connection to France?
Well, I have a studio in French West Africa, or former French West Africa in Senegal.
Mm.
I also speak a bit of French. I guess you could say I'm a bit of a Francophile. Over the years, learning through French painting has been a huge source of inspiration.
Is it kind of also a Dexter Gordon, Langston Hughes thing that, you know, they felt incredibly embraced and appreciated in Paris in ways that they never did here in the U.S.?
It's a Dexter Gordon, Langston Hughes, James Baldwin, Josephine Baker. It goes on and on and on. The love affair between black America and France is profound. However, I think that the one that exists today is much more depth and much more lived in real time. One of our biggest exports as Americans is our cultural output. Hip-hop has been beamed into everyone's ears, whether it be in France or in Sri Lanka. And what young people do all over the world is figure out how they respond to this new call to arms, this new call for personal expression, political freedom. What we as African Americans have given as a gift to the world is the ability to use improvisational style, the aesthetics of nomads shot out into the world. And now we've created a national and global sense of transiency, this ability to sort of move ideas, move thoughts, move aesthetic regimes into the places that we want them to be. Without getting too far into it, France is a very special place because they have a history of this, the history of embracing black and brown voices. Is one that should not be lost in this new turn towards the right. We have a very different France happening right now, and I fear that we're going to see some different cultural temperatures on the ground.
You mean in terms of tolerance and intolerance right now in France?
Precisely. I think that it's obviously something that we see here in America. We see it in the Brexit. We also see it in France, and all of those black and brown bodies that are in places called the jungle, that are in places that are sites of refuge, have to be remembered as sites that were once places of refuge for Eastern Europeans, Jews, homosexuals. Europe has been a place of refuge. Why should it stop with black and brown bodies?
Painter and visual artist Kehinde Wiley, great to meet you. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Wiley's works are beautiful, and they make you do a double take. You can see some of them at PRI.org. I highly recommend it. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.